Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. From Risa Walker, the award-winning author of the best-selling Kronos Files, and debut author Caleb Ansell, comes a chilling story of altered reality and psychological terror. Chase Ray sits perfectly still, his thumbs traveling across the screen of the broken computer tablet, stuck in the nexus between two worlds. Haddon Wood isn't real. It can't be. Another world, another reality, hovers just beyond his reach. He can see it sometimes. He can almost touch it. In that world, things are in balance. The dead stay dead, and the creature feature remains safely on the screen. That world isn't a patchwork quilt of every scary book or movie he's seen. In that world, the nightmares generally end when you open your eyes and people don't glitch in and out of existence. Chase is determined to return to that world, although he's a bit worried that the only way out is through the noose that seems to lurk around every corner. He needs allies to get back home. But how do you choose your team when you can't tell who's real? As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. Simon Says, the John Simon Thriller, Book 1 by Brian Thomas Schmidt. Master Detective John Simon is a tough, streetwise 17-year veteran of the Kansas City Police Department with a healthy disdain for the encroachment of modern technology into his workplace. When his partner is kidnapped after a routine stakeout by thugs with seeming ties to connected, wealthy art dealer Benjamin Ashman, he's determined to find the truth. But the only witness is a humanoid android named Lucas George. Reluctantly, he takes Lucas along as he begins to investigate and soon finds himself depending more and more on the very technology he so distrusts. Meanwhile, Simon's precocious teenage daughter begins to teach Lucas how to sound more like a cop using dialogue from famous cop movies. If only he'd use them in the appropriate context. This exciting new mix of near-future science fiction and procedural thriller captures the gritty realism of Michael Connelly's Bosch, the humor and action of Lethal Weapon, and follows the classic science fiction tradition of Isaac Asimov's City of Steel. From the editor of the international best-selling phenomenon The Martian by Andy Weir, and the national best-selling author of tales including official entries in The X-Files, Predator, and the Joe Ledger thrillers, comes the action-packed first entry in an exciting new series. Be sure to pick up Simon Says by Brian Thomas Schmidt and get into the series on the ground floor. Vedic by KJ Heritage. The dead don't always die. Top company scientist Chin Jelinek has committed suicide. Vedic, a half-alive empath with no memory of who or what he is, will die in 6 hours if he can't find out why, or so the company tells him, an added incentive to get the job done. Our hero soon discovers he is one of the skilled, a genetically enhanced human revered and despised in equal measure, a bloodhound with a terrifying past who'll stop at nothing in his pursuit of the truth. And the skilled always get their guy, don't they? Vedic, number 1, by KJ Heritage, on sale now. There's a link to it in the show notes. KJ Heritage's uncanny sense of pacing and story puts him at the forefront of today's speculative fiction writers. Gritty, intense, and compelling, Vedic is something you don't run into often enough in sci-fi, a cerebral thrill ride you don't want to end. Prepare to lose sleep reading Vedic, delicious science fiction. That's what other people are saying about it. Find out for yourself. Vedic, the first book in the series by KJ Heritage. The Unwelcome Trilogy by R.D. Brady. survivor, mother, leader, and humanity's last chance. Deep within the remnants of the United States, Lila Richards oversees a camp of 200 survivors. In a world where living is an everyday struggle, and only through banding together can people survive, the arrival of the unwelcome only made her job harder. Riley Quinn and Miles Jones have been raised by Lila for the last 5 years. They're also one of the cursed, the children between the ages of 13 and 18, whom the unwelcome kill on sight. No questions, no pleas, just death. Protecting one another and the people of their camp is ingrained in all of them. But now each of them faces increased danger as the reason why the cursed have been targeted by the unwelcome slowly comes to light. And that truth will shock them to their core. Now time is running out, not just for the cursed who are being hunted down by the unwelcome, not just for Lila and her family who will face the greatest challenge yet, but for all of humanity. The world changed radically 35 years ago, but today humanity's very existence is on the line, and the fight has begun that will ensure its future or its annihilation. Fans of A.G. Riddle, James Rollins, Suzanne Collins, and Brandon Sanderson will love the Unwelcome Trilogy. Pick up your copy of the Unwelcome Trilogy on Amazon today. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Ivy Claire on the show with me today. She is the author of the new book, Epica, The Tree of Akroff. And guys, this is a fantastic fantasy adventure. I'm hoping the first in a long series. Welcome to the show, Ivy.
Thanks. Well, you'd be right. We are planning 4 books, so it's definitely the first in a series.
Excellent. Excellent. We've got such a lot of stuff to talk about. But Ivy, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
You know, I remember being in a class in sixth grade. I went to a very funky liberal arts school in Brooklyn, and we were you had a compulsory puppetry class in sixth grade, and the teacher asked me this question that they never asked at the school, because like you weren't supposed to ask this question, like, what do you think you're going to do when you grow up? And I said I was going to be a writer, and I remember it so clearly. And she said, why? And I said, because my parents love books. And she said, oh, you're only going to do it because your parents want you to do it? And I thought, well, no, but that wasn't my answer. But I remember as the first time I said it, you know, pretty clearly.
Oh, that's so funny. Were you a bookish kid?
Yeah, I read tons of books. Although I wasn't like one of those introverted kids who says like, oh, all my friends were in books and whatever. But yeah, I read tons. My parents do work in publishing. So my dad would go to the London Book Fair every year, and he would bring back just dozens of British publishing for young adult and middle grade was much more advanced than American and much more intellectual and serious. And I just had the greatest library as a kid. So yeah, I read tons of books.
I'll bet. Do you remember a book, a series, or an author that just broke your imagination open?
Sure. Yeah. I loved Susan Cooper's The Dark is Rising series. It was one of my favorite works of fantasy or just kids literature ever. The Dark is Rising. There's about 6 books in the series. I love that. And I also loved this series about set in the 1920s in Paris called Claudine in Paris, sort of like a Art Deco era, Art Nouveau era mysteries. What else? I love those. Lloyd Alexander. And then for some reason, I was absolutely beyond obsessed with a book by Ellen Raskin called The Westing Game. It was my absolute favorite book of all time.
Such great memories. In the sixth grade, when you announced that you were going to be a writer and that this is, you know, the only answer that came to you, did you start thinking more seriously about that? And did you start kind of putting plans in motion, you know, even as a sixth grader, you know, through school, or was it just kind of dismissed?
You know, I never wrote fiction until several years after I graduated from college. I said I wanted to be a writer, but like for some reason I was much more interested in poetry and playwriting. I didn't really even think about writing fiction until I was in my 20s, but I did tons of poetry and tons of playwriting all through high school and middle school and even in college.
Along the way, you took a sidestep, if you will, became an internationally ranked squash player.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really consider it a sidestep because I'm one of the few people, and Kobe Bryant is sort of one of the other few people who think that athletics and creativity go hand in hand. If you look at like the Odyssey or like any sort of classics, the Homeric ideal is like an athlete, scholar athlete, you know, they exercise and do philosophical pursuits at the same time. So I was a really good squash player growing up. I started playing when I was about 8 years old, and by the time I was 12, I was the national champion in my age division, and you know, that continued through every age division. I was the number one ranked player in the country. And then I played in college, and I was pretty good then, too. I was captain of my college squash team and individual collegiate champion, team collegiate champion. And, you know, I was on the U.S. national team right after college, and I figured, you know, why not give this? I really liked the society of professional squash, not necessarily American professional squash, but international professional squash. It was super fun. So I thought I'd give it a crack for a couple of years. And I moved to Europe, and I played professional squash. I played in a couple of European League teams and represented the United States 6 or 7 times. So it was great, but I was writing the whole time that I was doing that. So,
gotcha. So. I was hoping you were going to give an answer like that because these kind of one-dimensional ideas that we have of the athlete or the scholar or the creative person, you know, we tend to put people in buckets, and we all know that people are mm-hmm. way more complex than that. And it's a fun thing to look back on, you know, at this point to say that. But when you're in the middle of athletic competition, could you see the nuance of that at the time? You know, that athletics are a creative pursuit, and this thing is feeding the other side of me.
Yeah, I definitely could. I think it's a dangerous line because if you're too creative, then you you know, can sort of suffer on court because you think too much. Like, it's very complex. Like, yes, I saw that creativity really served you well. You have problem solving on court. You have different ways to sort of approach the game. But often if you thought about life outside the court is when, like, the match would fall apart. Like, you have to have both this incredibly narrow focus and this wild imagination. And my focus wasn't so hot at the time. I mean, my fatal flaw as an athlete was like, oh, maybe I should be writing books or kind of second-guessing what I was doing. But yeah, I loved, you know, it's tricky. It's you know, true athletes are both have to be like driven and like almost like focused to the point of stupidity, like able to shut out the outside world in a way that like I was just like unable to do that. But yeah.
You said that in the middle of competition, you were writing all along the way. What kinds of things were you writing?
Yeah. Well, I have a second. I have another career as like a literary novelist. So I published 1, 2, 3. My 4 books under my real actual name. So I was writing those, or one of them.
Nice. What broke you into to writing novels?
So that has a lot to do with playing squash. My parents started to grow increasingly concerned about my life because not only was I just playing squash, but I had moved to Amsterdam to do so because there was, it sounds a little crazier than it is. At that point, Amsterdam was like a hotbed of, professional squash and also a really great place to base yourself because of, its centrality in Europe and this league system, but it was Amsterdam, and it was like, I don't know if this is a podcast for kids or whatever, but like it was super fun to live there. Let's just say that. And my parents were like, "Well, you know, what are you doing? You're living in Amsterdam. today I'm playing squash. And I was like, oh, I'm going to do something else. Don't worry. I'm also going to write a book. And they were thinking, oh, gosh, okay, so, like, when are you going to have a career and make some money and support yourself? They were not thrilled, although they were incredibly supportive. And they're my biggest supporters, of course. But I did it so they get off my case about moving home from Amsterdam.
But they were intimately familiar with the life and struggles of a writer because
That's why they were annoyed. Like, not annoyed, they're like a little concerned. They said, okay, so squash, it's changed a lot now. Squash is a lot more lucrative than it was back then. But, you know, you traded one sort of, you know, unstable occupation for one that might just break your heart. And, you know, because they know really well how difficult it is to be a published novelist. But, you know, it all worked out.
Right. What did you major in college? What is your degree in?
Oh, this is a conversation killer. I have a degree in classical Greek.
Oh, I don't think that's a conversation killer at all because when I saw that...
Dinner parties, everyone just shuts up.
Well, but it plays perfectly into the series that you're writing, Epica. I mean, that made perfect sense to me. What was it that drew you to these ancient but iconic stories?
So I have loved Greek mythology since I was really little. And as I said, I went to a very progressive and creative school where we were exposed to classics quite young. And I just loved mythology. I loved Homer. I loved all that stuff from, like, you know, sixth grade, seventh grade. We had to take Latin in seventh grade, maybe sixth grade. And then you could continue to study Latin from that point on, and then Greek was an option in eighth grade, and I just was like so into it, although I struggled with it because it's quite complicated later on in college. But I love translating. I love just getting to see those stories in the original text, and it was great. I love the heroes and the structure of I also really like, we don't have this in American or modern literature, these like really formal structures, Greek plays, Greek drama, and the epic poems have these fascinating ways of presenting story and information in very different ways that really appealed to me. I don't know why I like the formulaic quality of them, because they're both incredibly creative and imaginative, but also follow this sort of neat pattern. Anyway, I love stuff like that. I love the stories. I will read anything that has to do with classics.
Gotcha. So we've got this squash career, and then you're also pursuing writing, and you become published, and you have a literary writing career. Where do your and Kobe Bryant's paths cross?
Like, how did we start working on this project together?
Yes, yes.
Oh.
And did you know each other before that?
No, you teed up that question perfectly, I might add. I got a phone call out of the blue. I got an email one night saying, Kobe Bryant's going to call you on the phone tomorrow at 9 a.m. And I thought, that's just not going to happen.
Right.
You know, this is crazy. And he did, and he was looking for a professional athlete who also wrote novels and had a degree in classics. And there's like maybe one person who fits that profile, and it's me. So, so he called me, and he had this insane idea that he presented about, I mean, I couldn't believe what I was hearing because, you know, like you said earlier in the conversation, we have these narrow views of athletes, and, you know, I'm prejudicial as well. You know, I think, oh, professional athlete, you know, whatever. He can't be, you know, creative in the way that he was telling me he was, you know, that he wanted to write these fantasy books and they're mired in classics. I thought, am I really hearing this? This is insane. So I went down to his office the next day, and he told me that in his last year in the NBA, when he was injured, and he just became so obsessed and entrenched in this fantasy world of his own creation with sort of sports mythology and mythological heroes who were athletes, that he wanted to write sports sort of mythologies for kids. And I said, oh, God, like, this could not be something I wanted to do more. Like, I'm so excited. And so we started hammering out ideas, and it was too big. So he eventually hired other writers to write other books for his, you know, he started a publishing company. But the book Epica is the one where all the ideas, the original ideas, the core values and the theses of his company and it is like this classical world. So, yeah, it's a wild collaboration and completely unexpected.
And the book is just really amazing. I, as kind of a lifelong fantasy fan, and you know, an armchair sports fan, this is like the perfect marriage of those things in ways that you could never imagine that it would be. You guys have really, you know, when you say those things out loud, you're like, well, this is going to be weird. And it's just absolutely not. It's just, it's amazing. So, you know, you guys start kind of hammering out a plan. What are the mechanics of that look like? Okay. So we're building this world and these characters, you know, how do you start on something that like that?
Well, I'm so grateful that you said that because you're absolutely right. When you say it out loud and when he said it to me, I thought, as much as I love doing this, this is not going to work. Like, this just sounds nuts to me, because there's a really fundamental problem with writing a book about athlete heroes, which is, okay, so like Harry Potter's a pretty good template for this book, but Harry Potter's a magician. And when you have a book like a fantasy book, often the crux problem is the world is being threatened, right? So there's some kind of dark force or evil person or a problem that has to be solved, you know, be it Lord Voldemort or like a dystopian issue of people being, you know, disenfranchised or tortured or whatever, or like an asteroid like hitting the planet. If you have a book like Harry Potter, you know, the magic of Harry Potter is that magic can save the world, right? Magic can conquer these problems. It's really hard to come up with a story in which sports can save the world. And like, that was the biggest challenge. Like, so it's like you have two issues here. You have these kids who are really good at sports. And then Kobe wanted to write, and he was, you know, correct in wanting to do this, a fantasy adventure novel. And that was our biggest problem, is how do we figure out a story in which sports can be what solves the problem. You know, and it took us forever. Like, we had so many different versions of this. And the way we worked together is we would just do these massive, like, chatting sessions in person and then over text. You know, he travels a lot. He texts me the weirdest hours because he's often in China or whatever, like 2 a.m. It's like 4 paragraphs. My husband's like, is Kobe Bryant texting you again? I was like, yes, he is. He did that. And finally, you know, we had to figure out what we wanted to tell, what story we wanted to tell about these kids' journeys to becoming athletes, and what problems we wanted to have them pitted up against, and then what aspects of their sports educations were they going to use to solve the problem. And once we figured out that they didn't have to, like, play games to save the planet, and that they could use aspects of their training to sort of, you know, go on an adventure, that was when it all fell into place.
One thing that I love about this this book and the continuing series that this is setting up is that we've talked about it plenty already, the love of the classics and that feel that you get of these epic stories, these the gods and larger than life circumstances and characters, yet you managed to make this very accessible. And, you know, speaking of Harry Potter, it's really interesting when you see a story that transcends its, intended audience, in a weird way that, while, you know, it becomes bigger and more inclusive, than a air quotes kids book.
Well, you know, that's perhaps accidental, but also really works to this book's benefit. I have never written a middle grade book before, and Kobe and I made a mistake going forward where we didn't quite understand the difference between middle grade and young adult, and I've never written young adult either. So I have a more sort of, let me be clear about this. So Kobe doesn't think that children should be dumbed down to,
right,
and talked down to, that there are difficult truths in the world and these should be presented. I didn't quite get that we were writing a book for 8-year-olds. I thought we were writing a book for slightly older kids. And then, of course, the material is definitely for younger kids. But because we approached it with an idea that these stories are going to be universal and also some technical accidents of the way we wrote, it's a story that they say it reads up well.
It really does. It really does. And I think that this book is going to reach a massively wide audience. And I hope that it becomes one of those stories that it grows with kids in the same way that Harry Potter did.
I hope so, too. I hope so, too, because, you know, it is, it's really great to see sort of these more diverse characters. You know, I love Harry Potter, and I love that, J.K. Rowling said, well, how do you know that Hermione isn't black? And I thought, well, I mean, I'm pretty sure she isn't based on the descriptions in the book. She could be. But this book definitely is focused on kids from different backgrounds and different ethnicities and religions and, you know, lifestyles. And I think that for that reason, too, I'm really hoping that this sticks around.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, and not to disparage, Ms. Rowling by any means, but but how important is it to give that specific representation to characters and not just be ambiguous and say, well, how do you know that a character's not this or that? Well, you explicitly describe the characters in a particular way. How important was that to the two of you to really nail down?
Oh, primary of like essential. It was because I think people are prejudicial readers. You know, you can be, I think the majority of readers imagine that characters are, well, sometimes I'm not, you know, I'm a Caucasian, so I just see myself and, you know, I think that the majority of white readers would assume that a character is white unless told otherwise. It's just a fact. I don't think it's I don't think that it's a condemnation, but I think that it's really important for people to see these characters as looking as they do. I think it's important to understand that, you know, Vera is black. She's from the African continent. And that is incredibly important. And Kobe really wanted, Kobe's children are mixed race, obviously. And he really wanted characters who looked like his daughters, which is even more, you know, definitely a unique thing in fiction. I think we see a lot of, people from different minority groups. We don't necessarily see a lot of mixed race kids. And, you know, given that this book is set in some kind of version of the classical world, there are people from all over that region who are, you know, who are from sort of Carthage or African or, you know, sort of more Egyptian looking. So it's incredibly important that people know what these characters look like. Race is a primary factor in this book, I'd say.
The main characters that we encounter, Princess Preisha, mm-hmm. When you and Kobe were going back and forth and the world planning and the genesis of this big story, did you guys have characters from the beginning, or did they come about and evolve through, the conversations that you and Kobe had?
He came up with the characters. He was very dead set on having a princess. I was lukewarm on the idea because, you know, again, when you have the word princess, we both have young kids, and I'm the one who can't think outside the box. I think of like very traditional gender stereotypical roles, and he's like, nope, she's going to be a princess. I'm going to undo that because this is going to be about a princess who is up against her privilege and whose privilege doesn't serve her and who has things taken away from her. And has to suffer, you know, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. He came up with all of those characters. I'm not sure he came up with all of their backgrounds. I think I might have come up with what Rovi's background was as more of a kid who's sort of like I can't think of the technical word for it. He's what we call him, a star stealer. He's part of a band that lives out, out on the streets, and, you know, sort of like, in, Oliver Twist, sort of like Fagin's band. So I came up with that. But we wanted one highborn and one lowborn character. And then Vera is just sort of a representation of like the most pure, athletic endeavor that you could ever, you know, ask for in a character.
One thing that I love about this book is, there are some interesting designations, of people in the book. And the main one, that comes to mind is dreamers and thinkers. When you're dealing with a sports based, you know, kind of magic system and kind of worldview, those aren't designations that immediately come to mind. But it does harken back to what we talked about earlier in the intersection of, athletic ability and creativity. And there's just this big concept of just merging and melding these things that we think are disparate, but they really feed into each other. Would you mind talking about those designations?
Sure.
And how they play into the story?
Okay. Yeah, so, okay, in the story itself, there it's set in this sort of version of classical Greece where there are two dominant houses, which are basically two political parties, the Montagues and the Capulets, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, however you want to see it, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats. One is House Somni, that's the Dreamers, and one is House Relia, the Realists. And they are just these two parties that vie for control of Epica. And they don't intermarry. So Princess Preetia is the only royal born child of an intermarriage between dreamers and realists. And you know, we don't come down on the side of one of these houses being better than the other, one way of approaching the world philosophically or artistically better than the other. They're just different. So dreamers are more, you know, traditionally creative, more sort of, more roundabout in their approach to things, and realists approach problems head on. It's funny, I was reading this book by John McPhee, this legendary journalist, the other day, and he wrote a book called Levels of the Game, which is a meditation on a not particularly famous tennis match played by Arthur Ashe and Chuck Grabner, I think is his name. Yeah, Grabner, the U.S. Open in 1968, and he describes the two players' styles exactly along the lines of the book. Like, Arthur Ashe is sort of creative and languid and artistic in his play and like a liberal, and Grabner is this more like hard-nosed, you know, organized, you know, focused, driven athlete. So I thought, you know, it is actually real in sports. You know, Kobe will say that there are basketball players who are realists, who are just like have a clinical, cold approach to the game, and it's basket, 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 basket. And there are other players who score as many baskets, but it's a much more sort of creative approach.
Gotcha. And you know, these are kind of esoteric terms, but as you see it play out in the book, it really works. Were you surprised,
yeah,
in the writing and, you know, because you said earlier that, like me, you know, at first when you hear this out loud, this is going to be so weird and crazy. But, you know, at what point in the writing did it all start clicking together and it started making sense to you?
It took a while because there are a lot of ideas in this book. You know, there's dreamers and there's realists. There's this magical power not really magical power, this like this essence they have called Grana, which is, for me, like Kobe calls it emotional magic that you have to control to marshal your creative output. I think it's more of, you know, that talent that elite athletes have or that anyone has in their given field that sets them apart from anyone else. So there's the Grana, there's the realists and the dreamers, there's this campus and this magical island, and then there's this, like, world that's not quite classical Athens because it's sort of, you know, more modern. And I was very worried that it was never going to come together, and I spent a lot of time worrying that this was never going to work, and there was an earlier draft in which there were these beings who were, I don't know what the hell they were doing, excuse me. And then... we decided to pare it down. We hired an editor who's amazing, named Noah Wheeler, who this book would not exist without, and who's not getting enough credit for it. And we all sat in a room and we thought, we have to focus this. We cannot have too much in here. We need to, like, save it for book two. Or so we worked with Noah and pared the story down, and it just, and then when it really clicked for me is when I was able to, initially it was all from Precia's perspective, and then when we made it a two-hander with Precia and Rovi and could see the world as a much larger place and there's more room to explore it because we were getting different perspectives, that's when it really started to work.
Let's talk craft for just a minute, Ivy. In this book, this is a collaborative process between you and Kobe Bryant. It's also, yeah. It seems to me that when you go to your writing office or wherever it is that you write, you have an idea of the story. You've got a framework that you're working within because you and Kobe have already brainstormed all of this and worked out problems. And there's a bit of a plan in place, I would imagine. Does that differ from your other writing that you do, your literary adult writing? Do you plan ahead of time, or are you a pantser by nature when you're writing your other stories?
To be clear, I shall never refer to myself as a pantser. It's a
I hate that term
statement
too.
Against that word.
Yeah.
But
or discovery writer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, my other literary work is not so well thought out. Because young adult books or middle grade books are written for a younger audience, there isn't a lot of room to fool around and to, diverge and to, go off topic. And they have to sort of satisfy certain requirements, this type. I mean, there are writers like Jason Reynolds, who are really pushing the envelope of what you can do in middle grade fiction, like Long Way Down and his new one, which I can't remember the title of, which is terrific, are much more experimental. But him aside and a few writers of his ilk, there are requirements that a young adult fantasy book has to have. And it sort of follows three act structure like a movie would, And so it is much more regimented, and we do outline it. And I have to write these really quickly. My own work is a much more, I don't want to say tortured process, but it's not, I don't wish it on anybody else. I don't wish it on myself. I'm not looking forward to it. I do. But then when it gets, it's like for me, when anything gets going, then it's, you've got to like fight through a couple, a year. And then there's this moment where you're like, oh, this is awesome. But until that moment, it's pretty tortured.
The new book Epica is out everywhere today. We're going to have links to it in the show notes. Ivy, what's the plan from here forward, for the series, for these characters, this world?
Well, when we get off the phone here, I'm going to go inside my house because I'm sitting outside. So you didn't have to hear the dogs going bananas in the background. And I'm going to, do some final edits on book two before I send it to Noah and Kobe to see whether I've made a mess of things or whether I satisfied the story that we came up with. So I think Kobe's plan is to make this a 20,000 book series, but I'm only human. So I'm thinking initially it's four books because that's like an Olympic cycle, right? The Epic Games are. So this book opens at the Epic Games that just happened. So, in the end of the series, we will come back to the Epic Games. So right now we're planning four, but he and I were talking the other day about how we both want to, which means me, but he wants to write a sort of mythology, like sort of like a Dolores book of Greek myths about the gods of Epica, Granity. Granity is sort of the belief system. And so the Granity gods are going to get their own book.
Love it. I love it.
Yeah.
Ivy, I love this book so much. I'm recommending it to everybody.
Congratulations
on the publishing of it. And we are going to promote it everywhere. If people are just learning about you and everything that you do, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Yes, though it's through my actual name. So I have a website. It's Ivy Pakoda. That's Ivy tochoda.com, and I am contactable through that.
Excellent. We're going to send everyone to see you and to pick up a copy of the book, Epica, The Tree of Ekroff. Thank you so much, Ivy, for taking time to come on the show today.
Oh, this was such a pleasure. Thanks.
Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
Hello, young one. What ghoulish tale of horror shall we explore tonight? Shall we watch The Creep Show? The Nightmare on Elm Street? Child of the Night, give me your answer.
Which one would Mom kill us for watching? Said Buddy. Dad grinned and his eyes grew wide.
Which do you think, Child of the Jackal?
The Omen!
And we might have time for Omen too, if we hurry. She'll be home by 11.
I'll be back. Buddy ran to his room. He stripped down to his Yoda underwear and fished in the closet. 2 minutes later, he snuck back into the living room wearing his skeleton costume from last Halloween. He crept up behind his dad, who was cueing the movie. But David Rittermeier was too clever for that. He spun around at the last moment and bared fang teeth torn from paper plates, drawing a yip of surprise and a cry of, "No fair!" Daddy kicked off his Reeboks, plopped his smelly gym socks on the coffee table, another thing that Mom would hate, and killed the lights. The scary intro music began. The screen showed the silhouette of a boy, about Buddy's age. His shadow was a long, creepy cross. The Antichrist, the son of the devil. Born of a jackal on a night of astrological portent, destined to bring about the end times and the final battle of good versus evil. Buddy sipped Sunkist and scooted up next to his dad. As the movie got scarier, he slipped an arm through his father's and cupped his big bicep. Buddy could feel his father's pulse. Dads get scared, too. They flinched together, shouted together, pointed at the screen and covered their faces together. Buddy pressed his eyes to Daddy's shoulder just before the on-screen maid shouted, "It's all for you, Damien!" and dove from the roof, hanging herself. Buddy knew which parts he was old enough to watch and which parts he wasn't. He trusted his dad to let him know when to look again. Occasionally, his dad tricked him into peeking too soon, but that was part of the fun. They kicked their feet at the screen and shouted, "Look up! Look up! Oh, idiot! Don't get yourself killed!" At the climax, the hero of the movie, Mr. Thorne, discovered a birthmark of 3 sixes on his son's head and dragged the little Antichrist to the altar of the church, determined to spear his son with holy daggers and end evil forever. After it was over, the Rittermeier men sat silently through the credits. David put an arm around his son and ran his fingers through Buddy's hair. He wasn't searching for devil marks. He knew there weren't any. And Buddy was certain there were no daggers in his father's hand, either. Those things were just make-believe. Real fathers and sons don't do bad things to each other. They were queuing up Omen 2 when the power went out. "No," Buddy whined. "Not on movie night." Daddy went to the window. "It's the whole block. Sorry, Damien. How about, scary blackout? Go get the Ouija board out of the guest room closet. Cool. And candles." Buddy found the Ouija board, hidden under old clothes. When he shut the sliding door again, the sight of a monster startled him, and he let out an involuntary, "Huh!" sound. It was his own skeleton-bodied reflection in the mirrored closet door. He stared at it. He liked the effect of moonlight on his cheeks. Spectral, haunted, his eyes big and white. He clacked his teeth at himself, picturing his own grinning skull under his child's flesh, and gave an evil laugh. He was answered by a scream. A woman's scream. High-pitched and far away. One of the neighbors? Buddy dropped the Ouija board into a patch of moonlight and sat with it.
"What's going on?"
he whispered, his fingers on the heart-shaped wood planchette.